Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder. You can find everything that we do here today at vnnforum.com. This morning we're going to talk about E. Michael Jones's Degenerate Moderns, Modernity as Rationalized Sexual Misbehavior, and we're going to do a quick brief chapter two. We already did chapter one, which was a lot of the story about Margaret Mead, and now chapter two is going to deal with some related material. It's about sociology and how it's essentially set up to, under academic guise, put forward the idea that free love is common other places, and hence the West ought to adapt its sexual mores to these healthier practices found other places. Now, the truth remains that these practices are not practiced other places. They're, in fact, generally more repressive than the West, if anything, and Margaret Mead misrepresented slash did not understand what she found, and her Jewish mentor, Franz Boas, along with other Jews who had come along, are deliberately and systematically lying. And they're lying in line with the Frankfurt School game of destroying white society by essentially cracking it open, telling it that everything that it does is wrong, that it has an authoritarian personality, that all of its practices, which are designed to protect the young and put people in the right context and give them a through line through life to guide them in the right channels, everything is repressive, wrong, anal, obsessed. The Jews come into this healthy American context and they destroy it. And like I say, chapter one was quite a long chapter, and you can find that at vnnforum.com. Chapter two is a shorter chapter, but we'll pick that up, and then in subsequent broadcasts, we'll move on to different chapters. Chapter three is about homosexual is subversive of the double life of Sir Anthony Blunt. So we'll get in a little different vein. This is kind of a brief. I'm not sure why he did one long chapter that runs up to page 41, and then chapter 2, Blue Lagoon Social Studies, only runs about 5 pages, but we want to do the whole book, and we always do. So let's see what Mr. E. Michael Jones of CultureWars.com, a professor and one-man band for publishing and intellectual material out of South Bend, Indiana, where Notre Dame is. Let's see what he has for us. Again, Chapter 2 of Degenerate Moderns. This is the book that made E. Michael Jones's name, as far as I know, published in 1993, Modernity as Rationalized Sexual Misbehavior, which is the theme of E. Michael Jones's entire intellectual life. Blue Lagoon Social Studies, Chapter 2, Degenerate Moderns. As part of his attempt to understand what he terms the liberal death wish, as part of his attempt to understand what he terms the liberal death wish, in quotes, P.T. Bauer devotes an entire chapter of his book, B-A-U-E-R, devotes an entire chapter of his book, Equality, the Third World, and Economic Delusion, to analysis of Ali Mazrui, M-A-Z-R-U-I. He devotes an entire chapter of his book, Equality, the Third World, and Economic Delusion, to the analysis of Ali Mazrui's 1979. I'm doing that phonetically. I don't know. That might be slightly different pronounced. Ali Mazrui, no one I've heard of. So there's a chapter in Bauer's book about Mazrui. Mazrui's 1979 R-E-I-T-H, lectures, subsequently published under the title The African Condition. So Bauer has a chapter on The African Condition by Mazrui. Professor Mazrui, a Kenyan educated in Western finance schools in Africa, as well as universities in England and the U.S., kind of like Robert Mugabe, has a point of view that is easy enough to understand. He feels that the, quote, the decline of Western civilization might well be at hand, unquote, and furthermore that, quote, it is in the interest of humanity that such a decline take place, allowing the different segments of the human race to enjoy a more equitable share, not only of the resources of the planet, but also of the capacity to control the march of history, unquote. And this, in fact, when I was in school in the 1980s, studying international relations, my degree is in and my major, A lot of it is global systems and power balances, but a lot of it is also North owing the South. It's this barely coded, whites are bad, whites stole all the resources, whites owe everything to the coloreds of the world. And there are a number of different codes for that relationship, but I'm saying that's where he's coming from. And remember, we have the Jew Horace Kallen inventing the concept of multiculturalism, the idea that all cultures are equal except the West, which is inferior, which is parallel to the way that they say that race doesn't exist, but the white race does exist and is really evil. It's illogical, but they push them both out there at the same time. These are Jewish academics, throw shtick at the wall the same way that Mel Brooks does in movies. And then the Jew reviewers go around writing up what a genius Mel Brooks is when he's a complete idiot. And not much of what he did is funny, and none of it justifies his being called a genius. Well, these same little charlatans, these saltimbancos, these mountebanks, are at work in academia pushing bogus theories. What is multiculturalism? And again, this is preached by Horace Kallen, another Jew from Germany coming over here. I believe he was from Germany. This is pushed around 1900, not even 1920. This is pushed in 1900 when they create the discipline of anthropology, social anthropology, as distinct from bones and facts archaeology, physical anthropology, that the white, particularly, let's give them some credit, the Northeastern white, Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant, and that school of honest anthropology was replaced or superseded. Well, maybe not superseded, not intellectually, but culturally it was dominate. It came to be dominated by social anthropology that was the creation of these Jews coming over here from Germany, most notably Franz Boas, from which Margaret Mead, who was not a Jew, but was one of these deluded slash dishonest go-alongs, and other people that they would send out as kind of almost their epigones around the country to set up bogus franchises peddling these nostrums. A nostrum is a bad idea. It comes from the snake oil. It literally means like a bad medicine, a bad elixir. Learning words and learning their etymology and learning history are all related, and using and political argument makes use of these different things. We call things what they are. And we use nicknames and abusive nicknames, not because we can't argue directly, logically, formally, coolly, and without emotion against the position of our enemies, but because we make it better and more enjoyable and for our team, and more effective when we use nicknames and verbal attacks and smears. You should always be able to do anything that you need to do to get the job done, verbally, as well as everything else in life. And you can. You have it in you to do it. Now, so we're seeing some guy, I don't know if he sounds like he's a Muslim or something, but Ali Masruri, some kind of colored, is pitching the idea that the West, decline of the West, is a good thing. Blacks and browns need more money that they didn't earn, that's taken from whites, and they need to have more of a say in the outcome of history. That sound like a good idea? No, that sounds like a bad idea. Professor, this is Jones again picking up. Professor Masrui's aspirations are not difficult to understand. Controlling the so-called march of history has been the ardent wish of despots and megalomaniacs since the dawn of history. What gives Bauer problems is trying to understand why the West is so avid to cooperate in its own self-annihilation. And here Bauer can only pose questions without answers. Now, I don't know if P.T. Bauer was a Jew or not. Bauer is a common German word meaning peasant or farmer. Like Jack Bauer in 24 is a basic peasant farmer. Now here's a... Bauer can only pose questions without answer. Now, a block quote. How does it come about that African rulers whose military and economic resources are negligible are yet taken seriously and exercise such influence as, say, President Nyerere? And he's one of the, I may be pronouncing that wrong, but he's one of the when they decolonized Africa, a whole wave of African leaders took power in these lands, and they were basically 100% of them were completely corrupt, and President Nyerere was one of them, N-Y-E-R-E-R-E. Forgive me if I'm pronouncing it wrong. I mean, it's barely significant enough other than he was one of your typical corrupt blacks replacing the British or French colonials in the Francophone or Anglophone areas of Africa. Why does the West abase itself before, and they all went to textbook Marxist socialism, the vast majority of those who replaced the white colonizers from Britain. went immediately to typical third world corruption, big man, combined with Marxist socialism. And it, of course, failed, and they ended up doing much worse than they had under the colonials. But that didn't ever lead them to take responsibility for their actions or to stop blaming whites. Rather, they kept blaming whites, they failed. And then 30, 40, 50 years later, they grudgingly, some of them began to admit that maybe some of their problems were of their own making. But that's how long it took before they even started waking up a little bit. But, of course, they're still basically in the same situation. So, again, Bauer can only pose questions without answers. How does it come about that African rulers, whose military and economic resources are negligible, are yet taken seriously and exercise such influence as, say, President Nyerere? Why does the West abase itself before him or Mr. Kaunda, K-A-U-N-D-A, rulers whose own resources are extremely meager and who could not survive without large-scale Western help? One factor is the unfounded but widespread and much articulated feeling of guilt in the West. Conflict and dissension in the West is another. There are many people in the West who have come to dislike or even to hate their own society and its institutions, or who long for more money and power for greater status. They often look to the third world spokesmen and politicians as aliens or instruments in a civil conflict. Mere ignorance does not explain prevailing attitudes, because ignorance by itself is a neutral and does not therefore account for a particular slant of opinion. Now, he leaves the Jew out there, the Jew deliberately stoking this white hatred of our own culture and deliberately putting out, propagating, repeating the idea and presenting it as a valid education, the idea that whites are to blame for the ills of all non-white people. Jones, Bauer is talking about the Tanzanian president, Julius Nyerere, here, but he could just as easily be talking about the meteoric academic career of Professor Ali A. Mazrui himself, who has done quite well for himself since the Reith lectures. I'm going to say Reith, and it's probably anglicized pronunciation where the E is sounded, R-E-I-T-H. I have not heard of the Reith lectures. In 1990, Mazrui was lured away from the University of Michigan by the State University of New York for a package that will cost the otherwise cash-strapped university $325,000 a year. Mazrui's salary was featured prominently in a February 12, 1990 Newsweek article as the latest beneficiary of a bidding war for top scholars that is escalating among the nation's most select private and public universities. So this very valuable anti-white Arab or Muslim scholar is being paid $300,000+ a year to spread his anti-white doctrine. And of course, this is now, 30 years ago, so, or 25 years ago, so. Add a little inflation to that, what that would be today. True to the form already sketched out by Bauer, Mazrui's first act upon taking the Albert Schweitzer chair at SUNY Binghamton, the State University of New York, Binghamton, that's known as a pretty left-wing place, was to denounce the Belgian doctor, scholar, and humanitarian as racist. Schweitzer, that is. Mazrui not only attacked Schweitzer, whose Christian faith motivated him to become a medical missionary to Africa, he attacked Christianity as well, claiming that, quote, those who profess Christianity often have inflicted punishment with fire, unquote. In addition to his duties as holder of the Schweitzer chair at SUNY Binghamton, Professor Mazrui has a post on the committee responsible for the revision of the social studies curriculum of the state of New York. Mazrui succeeds the notorious Leonard Jeffries, and this was when I was out in D.C., this was a whole big affair, and all the New York, the ICE people and Sun people thing. Some of you may recall, younger ones may not, but he was a really anti-white black professor who propounded and expounded, advocated absolutely ridiculous non-scientific theories about whites being ICE people and black being Sun people. But Mazrui succeeds the notorious Leonard Jeffries, who's even more notorious, quote, curriculum of inclusion. I think that was the Portland Baseline essays, where some janitor in Portland who's black had written up this bogus black history that Jeffries was promoting, if I recall correctly. Who's even more notorious, curriculum of inclusion, had to be withdrawn after almost universal public outrage at its racist ranting. Mazrui's appointment in the place of the departed Jeffreys bespeaks an attempt to achieve the same ends by more diplomatic means. It is more than anything else a triumph of style over substance, which has remained essentially the same. So it's more anti-white bilge, but a little more polished and sophisticated. Then as now, Mr. Bauer's question remained unanswered. Why does the West feel obligated to promote people and curricula that call for its own demise? Before we can answer that question, we have to make clear what we mean by the West. It is this failure to make distinctions that lies at the heart of Bauer's inability to answer his own questions. The West, Western culture, whatever we want to term it, is essentially the absorption of the Greek philosophical tradition and the Mosaic moral law into Christianity, and the adoption of Christianity by the nations of the former Roman Empire and the nations of Europe is the basis for a culture that would emerge gradually over the next 1,000 years. The West is essentially the European enculturation of Christianity, and that enculturation led to an outburst of creativity unprecedented in the world. In his Templeton lectures, Reverend Stanley Jaki, J-A-K-I, OSB, not sure what OSB is, it might a society of something, maybe, I don't think it's Jesuit, it may be something else, makes the point, Reverend Stanley Jaki, J-A-K-I, makes the point that science arose in the West because of the Christian belief that the world was created by God as good and therefore worthy of study, as a predictable and ultimately understandable manifestation of the divine mind. That is a ridiculous claim. But it's Christians will take credit for every single thing that ever happened for human breathing, as well as for science. You could as well say their belief that God's ways are mysterious and unknowable would account for no interest in science, and that in fact the Greeks and the Romans who discovered the principles that allowed them to build aqueducts and have a flourishing civilization before Christianity was ever heard of are responsible for the start of science. But Christians will claim that everything good in the world is due to Christianity. The truth of the matter is that what's good in Christianity is due to whites, and they exhibited most of it before Christianity ever occurred. But E. Michael Jones will avoid that fact and try to claim credit for his cult. If the world is just Maya, the veil of illusion, then there is no compelling reason for a culture that believes this to devote much hard work to studying. Actually, the origin of science is in seeing that one thing causes something else to happen. That's, once you realize that, the rest follows depending on your interest and your ability to study it. It doesn't have anything to do with religion, whether you're studying cause and effect or not. That's my argument. If the world is just Maya, the veil of illusion, then there is no compelling reason for a culture that believes this to devote much hard work to studying it. Portrait painting, to give another example of the interaction between culture and religion, did not thrive in Aztec Mexico, where human beings were expendable objects of human sacrifice. The West arose out of a Christian matrix and created a culture that, for better or worse, conquered the world. Ever since the rise of Western technology, however, a persistent fantasy has arisen of taking the fruits of that culture, e.g. science and technology, without regard to the roots, i.e. the Judeo-Christian tradition. The Faust legend in its various permutations is just one expression of this latent desire. Again, how does Japan develop? Is it Japan fully based on Western technology, or they have abilities of their own? They're a purely non-Christian culture. The Faust legend in its various permutations is just one expression of this latent desire. Rousseau's Noble Savage is another. Nazi racism is a similar fantasy, attempting to attribute the achievement of the West to the mythical qualities inherent in the Aryan blood, with blood in quotes. Afrocentrism and multiculturalism, as paradoxical as this may seem, are manifestations of the same sort of thing. Okay, Michael, where is your... Chart. Where's your Nigerian chart, and where's your South Korean Bach? You know, as Christianity spreads around the world, it's strange that the only place that all this wonderful science and technology actually is created is in white lands. And in fact, the places in the third world where you do see Christianity, there's, say, 40 million Nigerian Christians, you don't see any kind of cultural flourishing or development at all. And in contrasted with places in Asia where there is no Christianity or little Christianity historically, there's plenty of development. You can say some of that comes from the West, and that's true, but some of that is also homegrown. So, to put it bluntly, he's wrong. The prime anti-Western fantasy for our age, however, was expressed by Nietzsche. 2 years after hearing the piano score of Wagner's epic-making opera Tristan and Isolde, Nietzsche made a lifelong commitment to a sexual revolution by deliberately infecting himself with syphilis in a Leipzig brothel. Thomas Mann saw in that gesture an act of demonic consecration. Whatever the motivation, Nietzsche was outraged when Wagner had second thoughts. When Wagner prostrated himself before the cross, and that's in quotes, by writing Parsifal, Nietzsche flew into a rage not only against Wagner, but against German music and all of Europe as well. Turning his disease-damaged eyes southward, he began to discern what he termed the lewd melancholy across the Mediterranean. As an antidote to Wagner's prostration before the cross, Nietzsche discovered Africa. The music, Nietzsche writes, describing his impression of Bizet's Carmen, is lively, but its liveliness is neither French nor German. Its liveliness is African. It has this destiny. Its happiness is short, sudden, and without pardon. I envy Bizet, therefore, because he has the courage to give expression to this sensibility, a sensibility which up till this time had no expression in European music, a more southern, browner, more burned sensibility. How the yellow afternoons of this happiness give us pleasure. We look out and believe that we have never seen the sea calmer, and how this Moorish dance speaks to us so tranquilly. How even our insatiability leans toward satiety. I can never get that word right. How even our insatiability learns satiety from its lewd melancholy. Finally, we have a love that has been transposed back to nature, not the love of some, quote, higher virgin, unquote, no sentimentality, S-E-N-T-A, I don't know what that is. Rather, love as fate, as fatality, cynical, without guilt, cruel, and as a result, just like nature. That love which is war in its means and at its basis the deadly hatred of the sexes. My translation. And that is a quote from Nietzsche. The attraction here, says Jones, is obviously sexual. Africa was now to fulfill the unfulfilled promise of sexual liberation that Nietzsche first heard in Tristan and Isolde. Nietzsche was not alone in expressing this desire. Jung, or J-U-N-G, found himself drawn to Africa for precisely the same reasons. Africa was where I longed to be. In a non-European country where no European language was spoken and no Christian conceptions prevailed, it was a place amenable to the desire of certain Europeans for release from what they considered the burden of the moral law, specifically sexual morality. Margaret Mead discovered the same thing in Samoa. She told the liberated ladies at Barnard, that's the women's college across from Harvard, in the 1920s, just what they wanted to hear, namely that in this state of nature, people didn't take adultery seriously. For lack of a better name, we will call this intellectual construct Blue Lagoon Anthropology. Blue Lagoon Anthropology, that's the movie with Brooke Shields, where they're naked, they're running around, they're 12, and they're living in a state of Eden is how it's portrayed. Not knowing shame or guilt, which is dressed up as academic sociology by Margaret Mead and her Jewish sponsor, in order to destroy the West. And so this Blue Lagoon anthropology, as he's calling it, it and its variants have been the deepest aspiration of modern intellectuals. Nietzsche had discovered Africa as the antidote for Western, i.e. Christian, culture, and we have been paying the price ever since. The whole curriculum of inclusion in the New York State and across the universities of this country fits neatly into this pattern, into this cultural pattern. Mazrui is being paid so handsomely, not so much to attack the West as to disconnect the West from its Christian roots. Africa, as used by the cultural revolutionaries of the West, is simply secularization carried to its logical conclusion. The fact that Africa positively teems with Christians means nothing to Mazrui, who becomes the official interpreter of Africa for the purposes of Western secularism. Well, if Africa positively teems with Christians, why aren't they having any cultural effect there the way they have in white lands, Mr. Jones? Professor Mazrui himself makes the connection between his version of Africa and the inexorable march of the secular ideal clear in his remarks he made at a panel discussion held on the SUNY Binghamton campus on September 24, 1991, on the topic "The Politics of University Education in the 90s. According to Mazrui, there's an extended block quote from Mazrui, "The history of higher education in the Western world as a whole has always been a history of a struggle to extend the cultural frontier, and each time the struggle has been resisted by conservatives, who in the end have been vanquished. In the old days in Europe, the cultural exclusivity was religious. There was a time at Oxford University when one had to subscribe to the Articles of the Church of England to be academically eligible. Harvard University, named after a Puritan minister in the 1630s, was a church-sponsored institution for two centuries. The problem at that time was not Eurocentrism, it was Christocentrism. Harvard was culturally exclusive, but in a religious sense. The politics of the quota system at American universities was originally intended to restrict the number of Jews admitted in favor of Christians. Christocentrism gone mad. There is still a lot of Christocentrism left at American universities, but most of the university life has been secularized. However, as the 20th century is coming to an end, we have reached yet another cultural frontier. Just as Harvard once had to try and shed off Christocentrism, all American campuses must now shed off excessive Eurocentrism." So they get rid of their Christian roots, and then after that they shed their white roots. "As in the past, the conservatives are resisting, and I believe, as in the past, the conservatives will be defeated." And as we read this, you know, 25 years after he's making that statement, you know, we see a guy up at Reed College who is basically banned from a conference seminar because he's insisting that the 1 in 5 women in college are rape statistic is bogus, which it is bogus. But he's kicked out because he's making it uncomfortable and triggering these feminists. So that's somewhat distantly related, but it's part of the same mentality of not telling coloreds or any of these other victim groups anything they don't want to hear while pretending that what you're doing is academic work rather than politics. Anyway, Africa is once again being compelled to take up the white man's burden in the West's inexorable march towards secularism, says Jones again. Africa has taken up the white man's burden in the West's inexorable march towards secularism. From this perspective, the answer to Mr. Bauer's question comes easy. The liberals' death wish really has to do with the death of the moral law. The liberals are willing to pay just about any price for the freedom to act out their sexual compulsions. In this sense, Thomas Mann's Death in Venice is still the seminal document of our age, and that's like I've read it, I'm trying to recall, I believe it's a middle-aged German who's kind of a pederast. He's homosexually chasing a beautiful boy down in Italy. like a 14-year-old or something like that, I think it was, something like that. He's saying Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, which what he's saying is that would be the dream of ultimate sexual liberation, where you can chase anything without any consequences or any moral restrictions or anyone looking down on you or questioning you, is still the seminal document of our age. People whose heritage is both Christian and European, people like Nietzsche, Jung, Margaret Mead, and presumably the Committee for the Revision of the Social Studies Curriculum in New York State, look south to tropical lands like those in equatorial Africa and the South Pacific as a release from the burdens of the Judeo-Christian heritage of the West. True or not, he's leaving out the Jewish nexus, the belief that they can destroy, the belief expressed formally academically through the authoritarian personality and the left-wing Jews of the Frankfurt School, is that by inducing promiscuity and general laxness or looseness in white society, they can destroy it. Destroying it meaning rendering it pliable to the Jews. And their multiculturalism, first formally brought out by Jew Horace Callan in 1900, is really multiracialism. And multiracialism is really mongrelism. And I blame myself, because I control myself, blame myself for not using mongrelism instead of ever using multiculturalism or multiracialism. So Jews promote general looseness, featuring as its star player sexual looseness or promiscuity, in their drive to induce mongrelism into the West and thereby destroy it, while they retain their genetic particulars by carefully protecting Israel and carefully working against out marriage wherever else Jews are located on the globe. But apart from that Jewish motive, he's saying that some of these white intellectuals seek relief and release from the moral law. Like Jack Kerouac, the author of the beatnik novel On the Road, the New York State Education Commissioner cast a longing glance toward the black continent. This is the idea that blacks are more natural, they're freer, they're looser. They have something that we tight-assed, obsessed, anal white people lack, and we need to copy their behavior. And he's going to quote Jack Kerouac, you know, one of the first beats, as they call them. They're beat from all their life experience, man on the road, bumming around, being hobos. Being cool, man. Like Jack Kerouac, the author of the beatnik novel On the Road, the New York State Education Commissioner cast a longing glance toward the black continent, quote, wishing I were a Negro, feeling that the best the white world had offered was not enough ecstasy for me, not enough life, joy, kicks, darkness, music, not enough night. What Kerouac saw in the Negro district in Denver was, quote, spade kicks, i.e. a racially sanctioned repeal of the sexual prohibition. New York State's multicultural, it's easier to be a nigger, it's more fun, at least in the short term. But in the long term, it's death. So you see, white civilization, a lot of the reason whites will lay down their white manness is that it's easier. It's easier to be. The lowest common denominator of a mixed or black ideal dominated society is much lower than in a formal, restrained, orderly, artistic, advanced white society. It's easier to be a nigger than a white man. And whites can choose. They can be a nigger if they want. Blacks don't have a choice. They are incapable of civilization. So Kerouac, one of the beat writers that are promoted by Jews because they help produce a desire for this looseness, or they exhibit it, they reflect it, or they even live it. They're chasing spade kicks. They want a racially sanctioned repeal of sexual prohibition. New York, and he will talk elsewhere about that. This becoming a big thing in the Greenwich Village in New York, where you have the Bohemians, and you're starting to have a Harlem build up with the black. Back then, the blacks dressed like whites, but they still sexually tended to act like blacks. And whites who wanted that kind of a life went there and became blacks. Hedonistic whites, libertine whites, bohemian whites mixing with Jews and the blacks up from the South. That's kind of the first milieu out of which a lot of the leftism came in the U.S. The formal communism and the artistic crank stuff that we have today. What Kerouac saw in the Negro district in Denver was spade kicks, i.e. a racially sanctioned repeal of sexual prohibition. New York State's multicultural social studies curriculum, with its relentless relativism and deconstructive skepticism, (parentheses) the subject matter content should be treated as socially constructed and therefore tentative, as is all knowledge, unquote, (end parentheses) is nothing more than an updated form of spade kicks. You know, it's tennis with a net down, is the phrase I always like to use from Robert Frost. about what he said it about free verse. He's like, the point of poetry is there has to be restrict. The master shows himself by his limitations, as Goethe said. Without form, poetry doesn't exist. It's just gabbling nonsense. You can't play tennis without a net to measure the shots, and so you need your form restrictions in poetry. So you need your factual restrictions in formal academic work, and throwing them to the wind with the cheap jibe that everything is socially constructed. Well, that's just tennis with a net down. Or as he's saying, using Kerouac's figure, is nothing more than an updated, the social construction of knowledge that leftist mantra is nothing more than an updated form of spade kicks. It is the secularist use of race as the final attempt to throw off the vestiges of the moral law, which they inevitably associate with the Judeo-Christian West. This is why, says Jones, Professor Mazrui gets paid so handsomely. He is being paid not so much to attack the West as he is to calm the sexually troubled consciences of the white boys who want to be liberated from the moral law. That liberation is the essence of secularism. And the liberals have been using race as the prime instrument in the transvaluation of all values, arguably since the Harlem Renaissance, but most certainly since the days of the civil rights movement. It's funny, E. Michael Jones never wrote any book tracing Hitler's politics back to an attempt to justify his sexual misbehavior. Think about that. I'll hit upon that at later points. Jones's theory is weak, but he never doubts it. But we aren't, fortunately, we are not limited to the we are not held to the limitations of Jones's genetic mind or political doctrine. So we can question him. We can question what he does not question because he doesn't think of it, or because he simply doesn't want to question it. All right, that liberation from the moral law is the essence of secularism, and the liberals have been using race as the prime instrument in the transvaluation of all values, arguably since the Harlem Renaissance, that's what I was describing above, but most certainly since the days of the Civil Rights Movement. And this would be a natural place for him to mention the Frankfurt School and the particularly Jewish political racial motive in unstringing white society, but he's still using Kant terms like the Judeo-Christian West. It is a fundamentally dishonest game in more ways than one. A university press release describes Mazrui as an Africanist who has devoted much of his career to explaining Africa to the Western world and the Western world to Africans. In this regard, Mazrui is a sort of double agent. In the United States, he gets paid to accuse the West of genocide against blacks and urge that this point of view be implemented in New York State's social studies curriculum. But what does he do in Africa? Why, in Africa, he's a consultant for the World Bank. And what does the World Bank do in Africa? It pushes for population control policies, i.e. abortion, sterilization, and contraception. And how do the Africans feel about these population control policies? Innocent Ugo Chukwu, that's his name, innocent, like a Catholic type name, Ugo, U-G-O-C-H, UKW, innocent Ugo Chukwu, writing in a, and who hasn't enjoyed an awesome innocent Ugo Chukwu column? I certainly have. Writing in a Nigerian weekly, called on his fellow Nigerians to defend themselves against against what he called the genocidal programs of the West. Bishop M.O. Unegbu of Oweri, U-N-E-G-B-U, O-W-E-R-R-I, Unegbu, Bishop Unegbu of Oweri, criticized an aid-sponsored condom campaign in Nigeria in similar terms. The West, he claimed, is promoting condoms and other contraceptives in third world countries because they are afraid of the consequences of continued increase in black populations. On September 13th, 1991, The Nigerian Catholic Bishops' Conference condemned the population control programs that promoted abortion, sterilization, and artificial contraception, and claimed that, quote, the best solution for the problem of unwanted pregnancies is a good moral and disciplined life. So Nigeria, which has, I looked it up once, had like 40 million Christians, and maybe the numbers varied, but I think I looked that up in the last year. And some of their bishops are actually now more conservative than the white ones in the West. In fact, that's pretty routine across Africa. And who's to say they're wrong? Because what they're preaching is certainly better than what's generally seen around them in terms of native African practices or modern leftist religious Christian practices. Jones says, it seems a safe bet that this is one manifestation of African, for example, the African bishop has spoken out against homosexual behavior in a way that has really outraged the faggot sodomites who run the church in the West these days. It seems a safe bet that this is one manifestation of African culture that will not make it into the newly proposed social studies curriculum in the New York State. Hiring Professor Mazrui as a consultant all but ensures that the old tradition of the white man hiring a black man to act out his fantasies of sexual liberation will continue. The Sobol, S-O-B-O-L, probably Jew, Mazrui collaboration. The Sobol Mazrui collaboration is an updated version of what Carl Van Vechten, that's a writer or founder of The Nation leftist magazine, which is associated with that whole Greenwich Village milieu that Jones writes about in Libido Dominandi, I think it is. The Sobol Mazrui collaboration is an updated version of what Carl Van Vechten, he was not a Jew, V-E-C-H-T-E-N-C-A-R-L-V-A-N, Carl Van Vechten proposed. The Sobol Mazrui collaboration is an updated version of what Carl Van Vechten of The Nation proposed in his Harlem Renaissance novel, Nigger Heaven. Probably that was written around 1920. The white editor tells the aspiring young black writer to do something on, quote, the Negro fast set, or, quote, a capital yarn about a Negro pimp, unquote, as long as, quote, the milieu is correct. So whites get off on this black underclass behavior because they want liberation from the moral law and its restraints, is what Jones is arguing, I think, correctly. And that leads to their fantasizing about blacks and their projecting onto blacks an image of this raw vitality. And we see this reflected pretty much everywhere, sports and everywhere else. The black is held to be manly or more alive than whites, when in fact he's simply looser and more animalistic. But the basic idea is that anything that is controlled, refined, or considered is considered less alive or less real than anything that is abandoned or quite as nature might have left it. Sexually freewheeling and red in tooth and claw. I mean, you can see why people would argue like that, but in the end, our Germanic Ordnung, or our organization, our love of organization and carefulness and design is where we need to turn more than Christian reality, Christian moralism. A simple consequentialism will do. If you want to act like a nigger sexually, you're going to reap the consequences of that. You're going to have bastards. You're going to have broken families. You're going to have social diseases. You're going to have a lot of misery. And a lot of death will come from it. Undeniable. And it holds whether you believe in Christianity or not. But again, you know, while he's saying that Nazism is a variant of the same thing, I'd like to see him pursue that, because the Nazis were for traditional sexual morality for the most part. Hitler was certainly not uncontrolled sexually. I don't see why Jones's theories wouldn't apply to Hitler. And if we apply Jones's Hitler and what he said, even in this very chapter, to Hitler, we would rationally conclude, without knowing anything else about Adolf Hitler, that he was a sexual libertine. And that was the opposite of the case. Although it has not been beneath Jones at various points in his career to promote Jewish communist lies about Hitler. So think about that. Jones needs to lie about Hitler to make his case at different points. And I believe, perhaps due to our tapping him on the nose for that behavior, that is, citing stuff from the pink swastika and then later retracting it, I believe we may have had an effect on him. Could be totally wrong about that. Because you see, what I believe is going on here, and as far as I know, I figured this out, and if someone else figured it out, I've never seen it written. And what bothered me, and I've talked about this before, and I'll throw it in here because it's appropriate, what bothered me was to figure, why does the Catholic Church, it opposes Nazism, and it opposes communism, but to my eye, and I believe it's not a matter of me, it's anyone who can perceive would pick it up, the Catholic Church absolutely hates, despises, fear and loathing, use Hunter Thompson, it fears and loathes Nazism, whereas it merely opposes communism. And I believe the reason for this is that it sees in racialism, racial specificity, particularly white racialism, a threat to its own supersession. That is, white racialism holds the potential and the possibility of superseding Catholicism. Catholicism means general. It's a general thing that supposedly we are all created by God in His image, and each of us is created in His likeness and His image. We bear one aspect of Him. And we all have human dignity, and we're all part of a body of men who are meant to worship the Lord. That's their theory. That's what they go with in their catechism, which I'm reading now, so that I'll be better informed when I'm talking about this. They see the fascist line was always, not everything with a face is human. That it's the differences between people that matter more than the similarities. And thus, any racial doctrine, such as arising from people who were, as more than they were Protestant, were Catholics, at least the leaders of the Nazis from Austria, like Hitler, presented the church a real threat to their point of view. And the Nazis have been defamed in a thousand ways. Whenever someone stands up to the Jew, they will be sexually defamed. With all the things that Jews are say are just great and fine everywhere else, they're perfectly happy to flip over and use them to make them look bad in the eyes of the more traditionally minded folk by saying that they fall afoul because they're a bunch of pederasts, pedophiles, homosexuals is the one they usually use with the Nazis. And every human and non-human form of sexual deviance has been alleged against Hitler by the lying Jews who control the mass media. And Jones has not been above reprinting some of those claims that originated in the pink swastika, which drew its data from the Jewish communist Magnus and his Wissenschaft Society, or whatever it was. I got the name wrong, but Jews promoting like an early forerunner of the Frankfurt School. Hitler's people got into power and cashiered them, and they were the ones who were spreading lies about the Nazis and their sexuality, and Jones has not been above repeating some of those lies. So it's our duty to catch him out where we can, keep him on the straight and narrow. Okay, anyway, let's go back to the text here now. We're almost done. We got about one more paragraph. So he's saying that Carl Van Vechten and the Nation back in the 20s, they're trying to get this whole, blacks are so cool, they're so sexually liberated and loose. Give me some cool stories about black pimps, man. That's what we want to run our publication. Let them see there's another better way to live, and these spades and their spade kicks in the ghetto, the black pimps. Multiculturalism, says Jones, is a renewed attempt to get what the white moderns wanted out of the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. The revised curriculum of inclusion is the 1990s version of nigger heaven. Okay, I'm not a little confusing, but basically the same idea can be come forward in different forms. They're trying to trump traditional white/Christian morality with spade kicks, depending on a particular academic discipline in question. So, as we open the last paragraph of Chapter 2 of Degenerate Moderns, so Professor Mazrui is in the enviable position of having his cake and eating it too. He gets to extort money from the easily blackmailed conscience of the sexually troubled secular West, which wants to use race as a tool in the transvaluation of all values. And he gets to collect again as an advisor to the World Bank, which is perpetrating abortion and birth control genocide on his fellow Africans. The common denominator, both here and in Africa, is secularism. As the spread of AIDS has shown, the real death wish of the West is its persistent desire to engage in sexual liberation. I mean, to me, that's just overdrawn. He's simply obsessed with his thesis. You know, it's not killing the West. Sexual liberation is not killing the West. It killed a slice of the craziest queers who were extremely unregenerate. And you don't need religion to account for that. He's simply, there's an element to Jones that is simply, I believe it's reflected in the high tone of his voice, like Tim Tebow. It's simply mawkish, childish. Look, if you act a certain way, you're going to reap certain results, but that doesn't have anything to do with Christian morality. It's not the cause of it. Plenty of fags have lived who were careful about what they were doing and didn't have millions of sexual partners, were able to live what he would call immoral lives without ending up in misery the way that he's kind of suggesting. But yeah, you don't need his argument often. He never really argues his case. He just cites examples that prove his case, but he never considers counterexamples that might contravene his case. He never considers alternate, simpler explanations that might cover the given facts. He just says, here's my thesis, and then here's the evidence for it. Okay, that's part of it, but there's more that could be done. I mean, go out there and find people who are advocating bastardized or horrible forms who are sexually regular. Is he contending that such people don't exist? That would seem to be a bogus contention. And if they do exist, doesn't that call his thesis inequivocal? But he never engages in anything like that. I guess that's the job of his critic, huh? Now, you'll notice I'm being a little more critical of him than I may have been at any other particular point, but it's just because I think he's wrong, in part. He's not wrong in his description of what's going on. He's somewhat wrong in his description of where the genuine motivation for it comes from. It's sexual liberation is seen as the Jews running all this stuff, and they're certainly running the New York State school system and college system as a tool. It's not that they're beloved of it in and of themselves. I mean, Jones doesn't seem to grasp, like, no one can really control what you do with your penis. So you don't need to justify it. People who are having a lot of sex don't feel any need to justify it. They just do it. He's the one who seems to be obsessed with the idea that people want to or need to justify their sexual behavior. In fact, they really don't. Generally. And he's not even bringing up the fact that Jews see this sexual liberation because of the, it's called consequentialism. The consequences of loose sexual behavior will destroy the white society. He's not bringing that up. That's the reason that they're promoting this stuff. It's not that people themselves want to rationalize what they're doing. Most people don't feel any compulsion to rationalize their sexual behavior. At least not people that I've ever met. I guess I could say that I'm not sure that having sex outside of marriage is quite the... life-altering spiritual horror that Jones seems to think it is. As the spread of AIDS has shown, the real death wish of the West is its persistent desire to engage in sexual liberation. As Professor Masrui has discovered, Africans of a sufficiently secular persuasion can reap impressive financial rewards by pandering to the white desire for sexual liberation, as exhibited by the relativists on the Cultural Committee and the condom hawkers at the World Bank. The children in New York get Blue Lagoon social studies, and the Nigerians get abortion, sterilization, and contraception forced down their throats. And the liberals, like Dean Moriarty, they get spade kicks. That was the loose runner in Kerouac's On the Road. His buddy. Or I think maybe the guy he admired who was down with all that. Like Dean Moriarty, they get spade kicks. And like Gustav Aschenbach, the fulfillment of their sexual fantasies and death. And Aschenbach, I think, was the German guy or who was the protagonist in Thomas Mann's book where he's the one chasing the child sexually, the beautiful boy figure in Death in Venice, I believe. So that's actually, that was a better chapter than I thought it was brief and technical, but it was pretty darn interesting. Anyway, I want to thank you for being with me this morning. We will do more from this book. We have done now two chapters. You can find it at viennainform.com. I'm Alex Linder. I'm on Twitter at TheLinderFiles, since they banned my real name there. And tweet lots of interesting stuff, epigrams, and interesting news items. And, of course, anything related to this sort of stuff, I leap on it. It's very, very interesting to me. We're getting us some good knowledge from E. Michael Jones. We've been reading his Degenerate Moderns as well as his other works. But thank you for being with me this morning, and I'll be with you again real, real soon.